We have a number of items on the agenda today, so we will get right into it. The clerk will note the roll. First item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for March 16th.
Mr. Chairman.
And President Jacobson.
I will move the approval of the minutes pending one minor correction on the front page.
Okay.
That being changing the date of our last meeting from March 10, 2002 to 2004.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, it's been 2 years.
Yeah, it's been a while.
About time we meet, isn't it? Okay. All right. So, Representative Jacobson moves approval of the minutes with the change to change the date on the front page from to March 10th, 2004. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion then prevails. The first item then on the agenda is House File 2585, Representative Blaine. Welcome to the committee. And Representative Blaine, your bill goes to capital investment from here. All right. And I'll make the motion that House File 2985 be recommended pass and re-referred to the Committee of Capital Investment. Representative Blaine, present your bill.
Thank you, Chairman Haas. And for the tape, Representative Greg Blaine, District 12B. Mr. Chair and members, House File 2985 is a very short bill and very straightforward, and I will not take a lot of time, your valuable time here in the committee today. I bring this bill before you today. What we're looking at is we're seeking $125,000 to upgrade the electrical lighting and other amenities at the Camp Ripley Military Museum on the grounds at Camp Ripley, which is in my district. Part of that $125,000 would also be used to conduct a pre-design study to look at the long-term space needs for the military museum. And Mr. Chair and members, I've been to the military museum at Camp Ripley a number of times, and it is a place where you can't just walk in and walk out. This place will grab you and keep you there, and there is a tremendous amount of information there. It's a great site and a great attraction for Camp Ripley, and I think it certainly has great benefit for the residents of the state of Minnesota in educating them on the military's role in the state's role in the military in this state and in this great country of ours. And, with that, I would ask that the committee would look favorably upon this request and ask for passage and be sent to the Committee on Capital Investment.
Thank you, Representative Blaine. Several of us last summer went to Camp Ripley and looked at toured the facility again, and I had not been to the museum, and that was one of our stops along the way, and I was quite impressed with, you know, how little room they had and how much they packed into that space. It was quite educational and very fascinating.
Yeah, I think
to see all the memorabilia that they've collected. And
yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think one of the key points about us asking for this is the fact that there is a number of tremendously important artifacts there that have a great value, and because of the constraints that this building has and the constraints as far as displaying these things, I feel that some of these artifacts could be in jeopardy of losing their value or the substance there at Camp Ripley, and I just feel that this is would be a very positive forward step.
Any comments or questions from members? Is there anyone here in the audience testify for or against this bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2985 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Capital Investment Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion then prevails. Thank you very much, Representative Blaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Representative Erickson is not here. Representative Swenson? There's Representative Swenson, okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill. We recommend to pass and go wherever Representative Swenson wants to go.
Okay, Representative Swenson, I believe your bill goes to Ways and Means at this point?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that would be correct.
Okay.
As far as I know.
And then, well, let's go through the fiscal information. We'll determine that when we're done here. All right, so Representative Seifert moves House File 2442, and Representative Swenson, if you present your bill and address the financial impact.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House File 2442 is a bill that was brought to me, and I was asked to carry. It makes changes to current Minnesota law that established a central notification system for farm product liens in the Secretary of State's office. The central notification system we use today was set up over a decade ago. It has worked quite well ever since for lenders, producers, and farm product buyers. It provides farm lenders with an easy and convenient way of letting buyers know when there's a lien on certain farm products. It's also a convenient way for buyers of farm products to tell when they need to write a check to both the seller and the lender. Mr. Chairman, I have with me Mr. John Appitz, who will go further into the bill. And we also have an amendment.
I see that on 1161 amendment. Representative Swenson? Okay. Representative Seifert, do you want to move that one?
So moved.
All right. Representative Swenson, what are you doing with the amendment?
I'm going to ask. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Appitz at this point to explain the remainder of the amendment.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Appitz.
Thank you.
Your name for the record and who you represent, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and I represent Farm Credit Services here at the state capitol. As Representative Swenson said, we're updating a system here that's been in place for about the last dozen years, created back in the early 1990s, to centralize the information that has to move between lenders and buyers of farm products relative to liens that are in place on those commodities that a loan has been made on. And to give you a quick little other setting to understand this, the legislature made some changes in about 2000 to the Uniform Commercial Code. This deals with liens on products, including farm products. The next year, 2001, we made some changes to the farm products liens, which were absolutely a mess and have been updated and cleaned up and made much more effective. We need to align this system, which gives notice of those liens, to conform with the Uniform Commercial Code and the other changes we made in the Farm Product Lien Statute. Well, all that took place in 2002, the federal Congress authorized the use of electronic noticing of farm product liens in the Ag Bill in 2002. So the effort here is to use a paper system today and make it an electronic system using the Secretary of State's office to provide notice to buyers of farm products that there are liens in place on those products. We've been working on this for a couple of years. It's sort of a labor of love. It's one of those boring things that somebody has to do, but a bunch of us got together, legal practitioners, bankers, lenders, buyers, farm organizations, Secretary of State's office, county recorders, to try to come up with the best bill that's possible. And we believe we've done that. This has gone through a couple policy committees, both agriculture and judiciary. So I think the bill is in good shape. We had hoped that the bill, however, Mr. Chairman, would be revenue neutral and that we'd be able to do this without the costs incurred in programming at the Secretary of State's office. However, recently we discovered there are going to be some costs in fixing up her computer so that she can handle this particular system. The amendment that's been added to the bill just now would help cover those costs.
Mr. Appert, we have the amendments before us. We haven't voted on it yet.
Excuse me. Okay. Pardon me, Mr. Chairman. The amendment that's before you, and there's Representative Bert Black from the Secretary of State's office who can give you more specific details on this. The amendment would cover the $60,000 in programming costs in the Secretary of State's office, their computer system, their central computer system, to make sure that lenders would be able to file
right at their offices into this system rather than necessarily
going over to the Secretary of State's office or the county recorder's office. So what it imposes is a $10 surcharge on each of the roughly 6,000 filings that are processed each year through their office to cover that $60,000 cost. $10 times 6,000 filing for 1 year. You'll note that this is crafted as a one-year amendment, so it would go into effect at the beginning of this fiscal year and end at the end of the fiscal year. I've been working for the last several hours to get us all to agree that this would be a good idea to have happen. I'm not here to tell you that everybody has agreed that this is the way it ought to come about. So I apologize for that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. But it is not unusual to impose a surcharge to upgrade the Secretary of State's computer systems. We've done that with UCC. We've done that with other filing systems. So that's why the amendment was crafted as it is, and that's why it's before you in that fashion.
Okay. We have a technical, Mr. Shepard, question.
Mr. Chair, members, I just had a question for Mr. Eppitz or Representative Swenson or maybe Mr. Black. The remainder of the bill has a conditional effective date, and it looks like you'd want this section to be effective July 1st, 2004, regardless of whether the rest of the bill takes effect. And if that's the case, I would suggest just an extra sentence that would say Section 16 is effective July 1st, 2004. I'll give it to Ms. Carter in the correct form.
Okay. Where would we insert that?
Mr. Chair, that would be on page 24 after line 17, or after line 11 of the bill. Just be an addition to the effective date.
Okay. All right, and so that would read the effective date of Section 16 would be July 1, 2004?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chair,
Mr. Appert.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair. That's a very good catch on your part, Council. What happens here is once the legislature approves the changes to the system, they also have to subsequently be reviewed and concurred in by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This is sort of a, this has a federal umbrella on it, and that's why the effort, why we're changing the law, but we have to ask the USDA if it's okay with them. In the meantime, what this would do is collectively to improve the Secretary of State's computer system. So that would need to be effective.
Okay.
Amendment work properly.
All right. And we'll just incorporate that into the amendment. And then any questions on the amendment? If not, Representative Seifert renews his motion on amendment number 1161. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion and prevail. All right, now back to the bill. We have, it looks like we're going to generate $62,000 of revenue from the fee, and we have an and that is then going to purchase computer equipment. Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's for programming costs for the revising system development costs.
Okay. So this is all going into computer equipment, computerization. Okay. All right. Any questions from committee members or comments? All right. And representatives, if not, is there anyone here in the audience to speak for or against this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I think there's probably some others from the banking community that may wish to speak to it. I know there was some on the way over here. So,
do they agree with it or disagree?
We'll let them speak for themselves. In this particular instance, I'm speaking for Park Credit Services.
Okay.
Don't want to speak for my fellow.
All right. Are they outside?
David is here. David?
They might be outside. Oh. Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you state your name and who you represent for the record, you may proceed.
Mr. Chair, David Stilbred with the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. I think that in general we're supportive of this bill and see it as a good streamlining process. A lot of people have worked very hard on this to get it to where it is. respect to the fee, I called up a number of members this morning. While we do not have an official position on it, the feedback that I got was that they weren't upset about the fee. They would like to make sure that it's 1 year, 1 year only, for the purposes mm-hmm. that the amendment pertains to.
Okay.
And that's about the extent of the feedback.
Okay. And Mr. Skibarita, have you seen the amendment?
I did not see the words. I know the concept.
Okay. Okay. Because it does address your concerns, yes. I think, in there. So, okay. Good. Thank you. Any questions for the testifier? All right. Thank you. Anyone else here to testify for or against the bill? All right. If not, Representative Seifert renews his motion in House File 2442. Be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Committee of Ways and Means. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Representative Swenson.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson here yet? Okay. Representative Crinky, Kurdals, okay, why don't you go down and get Crinky and I'll do... Right. Representative Jacobson, do you want to pass that down to him?
Sure. Which bill?
6.20. Representative Haas, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move that House File 2629 be recommended to pass, and then I believe this goes to the floor.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
Members, this is the technical bill that we looked at the other day in GovOps, and basically it's cleanup language for Minnesota planning. It provides for energy forward pricing, so that we can look at reducing our fuel and energy costs within the state budget. It provides for Small Business Procurement Council reinstatement, and then it deals with the Technology Enterprise Fund, which is the reinstatement language. And you have a fiscal note before us that is revenue neutral. So there's no impact to these changes.
Questions from members? Okay. Would anybody from the department like to comment? Seeing no further discussion.
Please means. Okay.
Would you like to renew your motion, Representative Hunt?
Chair, I'll renew my motion that House File 2629 be recommended pass and then be referred to the Committee of Ways and Means.
Okay. Any last offers of discussion? Okay, seeing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations, Representative Hunt.
It's a new speed record.
I know it.
Okay.
And Erdahl, has anybody got me? Try to check him down. See here. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so, that one done. We're just trying to locate members, so if you just be patient with us for a few minutes, we will. Everybody has different committees and to be in right now. And you went down.
Representative Riddle's bill was heard in government office. If you'd like me to present it, I don't think it's a controversial bill, just to save time.
Let's see if we can locate him. If not, are you a co-author on that bill? Or?
I'm not, but
okay.
I did hear it once. So.
Fully informed, ready to vote. Riddle and others.
Oh, yeah.
You're in the hot seat, buddy. All right. Welcome to the committee, Representative Krenke. You're old committee.
Little handout there, Mr. Chairman.
I just want to know how it feels to sit on the other side. The dark side. On the dark side.
Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chairman,
Bob moved the bill for you.
I moved the bill. I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
House File 2684 deals with a situation that was brought to light last year where we had an incorrect citing in statute of how dollars were to be expended. It was through some fine work by staff that pointed out this error. I then asked the legislative auditor to investigate the matter. What you see in front of you is one of the recommended solutions by the legislative auditor to deal with the issue. I could just to turn members your attention to the legislative auditor's report on energy utility assessments. If you look at page one, it talks about the gives you the summary, but the conclusions on page one. The starts in the second sentence. It says the Department of Administration inappropriately expended $161,200 on energy benchmarkings for existing public buildings. The department stopped work on the project February 20th, 2003, when concerns were raised about the use of the funds. It says we recommend that the department repay the assessment of the account for the allowable charges or seek legislative authority to otherwise resolve the inappropriate use of the assessed monies. it's the reason you have House File 2684 in front of you. And as I said, the legislative auditor, Mr. Chairman, said that this could be resolved in one of two ways, either A, seeking a retroactive approval of the dollars, or B, the department could take the dollars from their budget. And Mr. Chairman, at this time I would like to move the delete all, or have you, if you would please, move the delete all amendment H2684DE1.
All right. Representative Krenke, I will move the DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The DE1 amendment?
The DE1 amendment is the option A under the legislative auditor's report. Rather than being retroactive, that this amendment would allow the Commissioner of Administration to use up to $163,000 of unspent or unencumbered general fund appropriations to repay these funds. Members, the reason that I bring the delete all amendment, if you turn in your book, in the legislative auditor's report to page 13, it's appendix B. This is a letter of July 13, 2001. It was addressed to Senator Anderson, Senator Metzen, Representative McElroy, Representative Wolf, from the Commissioner of Commerce and the Commissioner of Administration at the time. The technical changes needed for the 2001 Minnesota Law Chapter 212. If you look at the second paragraph, it says, interpreted literally, these errors could impact the ability of the involved parties to properly implement the legislation. It is our hope upon raising these issues, we will have permission to implement the legislation based on legislative intent and make the language corrections early in 2002 session. Members, I don't think that you send a letter to legislator is saying that we're going to go ahead and do what we want anyway, even though we know that the law is incorrect. They knew that the law was incorrect. They were aware that these technical changes needed to be made in order for them to properly expend the dollars. They chose to, by letter, address this issue to four members of the legislature and continue to spend the money until such time as I pointed out the error in February of last year. It is for that reason that I believe that the agency should repay the dollars out of their general fund appropriation. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time. I'll stand for questions or comments by committee members.
So, Representative Krieger, what you're saying is that we had two commissioners who took it upon themselves to basically ignore the current state statute and decided to spend this money for this particular program without legislative authority, and we're going to come back in the following legislative session to try to get it.
According to the work in the investigation of the Legislative Auditor's Office, yes, they knew that the language in the 2001 session was incorrect. It was a technical error. By this letter, felt that that was sufficient notice. They continued to expend the money. There was no change in the law. This would have been obviously an issue for a revisor's bill that could have been taken care of in the 2002 session. It was not done, and these agencies, knowing that it had not been done, continued to expend the money in contradiction to the law, knowing full well that they were in contradiction to the law. And it was only, as I said, after I asked the legislative auditor to investigate the issue that they stopped the procedure. So it's my belief that rather than taking the easy out of saying, well, retroactively now in 2004, we're going to go back and change the law so that these funds don't have to be reappropriated. We can just forgive and forget, move on, and no one's going to be concerned about this issue. I think that these agencies should fess up to what they did, and they should have to pay the funds back that were misspent out of their existing appropriation.
Okay. And these were commissioners under the previous administration. So our people inherited this.
Chairman Haas, as you know, this commissioners that are addressed here, the former Commissioner of Commerce, the former Commissioner of Administration, but the practice continued into the 2003 session. I mean, it would be obviously, I would think, maybe a little difficult for them to understand, but again, the same people under these commissioners, I mean, the commissioner may be different, but the people who were aware of this, the people who were cognizant of the program and working on it certainly were still aware of what was being done. And again, I don't know what happened during the 2002 session. I don't know why it didn't get put into a revisor's bill. I don't know why maybe there wasn't a bill introduced to make the changes. I don't understand that or know that. Maybe there's some other people in the room that do know. I don't. I'm just saying that when you knowingly and willingly violate the law, you should pay a penalty.
Okay. Members, any comments? If not, I'll. Is there anyone here from the department or to testify for or against this? Ms. Elsko, welcome to the committee. If you state your name and who you represent for the record, you may proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kath Alska, and I'm an assistant commissioner with the Department of Administration. And we certainly are in favor of the bill as it was originally submitted, and we do believe that we ought to have the choices that the Legislative Auditor's Office allowed us to take in their report. We are very sorry that this happened, and certainly the message has been received. We started out the project needing more money for the benchmarking than for the sustainability guidelines. The opposite got in the legislation. We did write the letter. We did not spend money initially on the B3 project. As things moved on, it honestly slipped through the cracks, and we did spend some money. We were very glad when it was pointed out to us. We stopped the project immediately despite having some reporting deadlines. In addition to stopping the project, we've been assessed the utility companies have been assessed $500,000. We returned $358,000 to the utilities because, again, we were waiting to see how the matter would be resolved, and we wanted to be very careful that we tried to correct our mistake, make sure we walked forward in a correct manner. We did also take steps to avoid this in the future. This was a little bit different legislation in that the funding was at the language was in the bill in the first couple pages. It was a fairly large bill. The funding was at the very end. They weren't tied together. We have now asked on contracts that the language carrying the funding gets put in the contract so that this sort of thing doesn't happen. We're also concerned about the fact that what the impact this has on the general fund, and actually this current language goes a little further than the language by the legislative auditor, which says the department has to repay it. It doesn't define that it has to be, or one of the options is the department has to repay it. It doesn't define just general fund. The bill as it currently is before this committee would actually limit our abilities in two ways from what the legislative auditor gave us. The impact on, again, we do not have $161,200 in general funds sitting around. General funds have been cut and cut. This could affect 2 to 4 staff members for layoffs for things that they may well have had absolutely nothing to do with. There also has not been any concerns from the utilities. The utilities have a vested interest in saving money. For every dollar that is put into energy conservation, they save $3 in fuel consumption and construction of additional power plants. This is a bill that this whole process is to find out what buildings are consuming a lot of energy and find ways to retrofit them and to save 30% of energy. The language has been corrected so it's allowed to use the money, but again, it is not retroactive. And none of the utility companies, there are 22 utility companies involved here in putting these funds together. Not one of them has come forward with any concerns that this money was misspent. So again, we recognize the fact we made a mistake. We made a severe mistake. And we hear the message loud and clear and have put, again, some processes in place to stop this, and we are moving forward now that we do have the money in the language in place with the money.
Okay, Ms. Elsker, I'm looking at here that in June 2002, Department of Commerce assessed the energy utility companies $500,000. Was that authorized by any legislation, or was that just done on part of Commerce to do this?
Mr. Chair, that is in the language.
Okay. But then you have refunded $357,000, according to the financials here, to the utility companies for that assessment. Don't we owe them the additional money?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the utility companies, or Commerce has the ability to assess the utility companies $500,000 annually for this project. When we discovered the fact that the language did not include the one portion, the benchmarking portion of this project, we stopped work on the entire project, did not do any more work on the project for that fiscal year. Thus, we had $358,000 of the $500,000 assessment that we had not spent, and we returned that to the utility companies. The work that we did, $161,200, will be of benefit to the utility companies as we move forward on the benchmarking project.
Is there any comments from staff here? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm absorbing some of this here.
Representative Krinke, did either of these departments continue to spend this money after the July 13, 2001 letter, which from what I see is the date on which they acknowledged that they knew they didn't have the authority to spend the money?
Representative Krinke.
Just the
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Newman.
To help Representative Krenke out, I'm looking at Appendix B of the attachment to the Office of the Legislative Auditor that you had referred to in your testimony.
You're referring to the letter to Mr. Nobles on July 30th or July
31? Mr. Chairman.
Representative Newman.
Representative Krenke, no, I'm referring to the letter to Senator Ellen Anderson, Senator Metzen, Representative McElroy, Representative Wolf, dated July 13th, 2001.
Yes.
You have that letter now
yes.
tonight?
Yes, yes.
Can you tell me, Representative Krenke, whether either of these departments continued to spend the money after July 13th, 2001, which by my estimation in looking at this letter is the date on which they acknowledged they didn't have the authority to spend the money?
Yes, Representative, that's the time period we're talking about, that these two agencies. First of all, let me clarify for members. What was in the statute was, or what was in the law, was the allowance to assess utilities in order to conduct an energy survey of all public buildings in the state of Minnesota. And Ms. Auska can give you more details about what that program was and what the intent was. But the point was that there was a technical error in the way the bill was written. It did not say that these assessments could be spent to conduct this work. It wasn't cross-referenced in the bill properly. So this letter was sent to these legislators. I don't know how many other conversations may have occurred or what the follow-up on these letters were, but these two agencies, the Department of Commerce, collected the fees. They transferred the fees to the Department of Administration. The Department of Administration went out and expended the dollars, got a vendor to go do conduct this study, the energy audits of these public buildings in order to accomplish, as Ms. Gauska said, hopefully energy savings, energy consumption reductions. So from that time of July 13th to February 2003, so during that year and a half, the agency continued to collect the revenues. As the report says, in violation of the law, they were supposed to collect the fees as the monies were expended. They collected the monies ahead of time, transferred them to the Department of Administration. The Department of Administration spent them. That process went on for a year and a half after they knew that there was an error in the way the legislation was drafted, or the way that the law read. So my feeling about that is that, A, you purposed, they knew that it was wrong. They continued to do it. Then when it was pointed out, they say, well, gee, I'm sorry. And there's no fine here. We aren't fining the agency saying you have to do something above and beyond. Repaying the money. This is restitution is what we call this. This isn't fining the agency for what they did. This is restitution for saying you spent money that you did not have the authority to spend.
Okay. Representative Thiessen, do you have a comment?
Just to clarify, but last year we gave them the authority to spend the money, so now they could spend this money?
Correct. Last year, the legislation, the changes that needed to be made were made, allowing the assessment against the utilities to go forward, and allowing the assessments against the utilities were always legal. The expenditure of the funds was the part that was not
permissible under the law. But now they are.
But that's a permiss, and the money was spent on a permissible thing. Not at the time.
Futures, yeah.
Currently, but if had this law been done 2 years ago, it would have been a permissible thing.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Strand.
Quick one, Mr. Chair. Maybe I missed it, Representative. I just can't find it. The money to be paid back would be paid back to the general fund. Is that correct?
Who's
getting paid back to?
The money needs to be, I believe, sent back to the Department of Commerce to be reallocated to the utilities. The utilities were the ones that were assessed to conduct this work, and therefore, okay, the money is really was improperly collected from the utilities to do the study.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further questions? Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I apologize for being late. I believe Representative Krenke has given you an accurate description of the events that have transpired up to this point in terms of the errors that were made by the Department of Administration in terms of interpreting or misinterpreting the language in terms of the appropriation and what it can be spent on. Regardless of the fact that the original appropriation amount included both the forecasted amount for the developing the guidelines as well as developing the benchmark criterion. However, that the language did not necessarily reflect that. There were opportunities, I think, for the department to address this, you know, from 2001 until ultimately it was addressed and the legislature passed the revised language last year. I'm not here to justify the mistakes in the past. I am here to say two things. One is this kind of error is not going to occur on my watch in the Department of Administration in the future, and I think that's important for this committee to hear. Secondly, we believe that there are a couple things that ultimately I think represent a more workable solution here than the amendment proposed by Representative Krenke, in that as part of when this was brought to our attention, or at least my attention, by Representative Krenke back in February of 2003, we immediately ceased all activities and ultimately did not resume any activities for any of the or the functions until the legislature addressed the issue. And so subsequently, there was approximately $350,000 that was returned back to the utilities as part of what we took on as a mitigation factor was an internal department commitment that, despite the fact we did not have that $350,000 or the access to that $350,000 because of the ceasing of the activities for that period of time, we were not going to change the scope in terms of what we were going to accomplish over the five-year period. So what we ended up doing and are working on right now are mitigation factors that would involve how we can adjust our work plan and ultimately focus with internal resources so that we can continue to make progress and achieve the objectives that the legislature set out for us over the five-year period, but do so in a way that would not result in agency reductions. And at this point, that's what this amendment would result in, is an agency reduction. And as I look at where my options are in my agency budget, quite frankly, I would have to lay off people. And I do not think that this is the most effective way for the department to ultimately right this ship make sure that we accomplish what we told the legislature that we would accomplish, and address the problems that were pointed out very clearly and succinctly both by Representative Krenke and ultimately by the Office of the Legislative Auditor.
Okay. Questions, Representative Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Krenke, what would your thoughts be with respect to the Commissioner's suggestion, keeping in mind that this Commissioner was not on deck when these violations occurred, and there will be a direct impact on some of his current personnel?
Representative Krenke.
Chairman of the House, Representative Newman, I've spoken to the Commissioner Lamb about this situation previously. He has obviously offered similar or same comments with regard to the agency. My problem with that is that this boils down to one simple situation for me. These are people who are in state employment that knew this wasn't. I'm not talking about Commissioner Lamb. I'm talking about the people who were involved in conducting this work at the agency level. They willingly, knowingly flaunted the law. They knew, by their own admission in this letter, that the law was incorrect. Yet they proceeded to spend state funds. They continued to go ahead on this project knowing that the law was not correct. They knew that. I don't care whether you consider, you know, whether it was technical or whatever the situation was. We're all familiar with that process here. So, these individuals within these agencies flaunted the law, flaunted the legislature's process, and said, in essence, we don't care what you as legislators may think about what we're doing. We're going to go ahead and do it anyway. And the problem I have here is that this body commands the respect and commands that the laws be followed. And if you willingly and knowingly violate the process, this is not a difficult thing to change. We all know what revisers' bills are. We all know how the process is. So they could have changed it in 2002. They could have said, we do not have the authority to spend this money. There's nothing here that threatens life or safety. This is not a situation that demanded immediate action on the part of the agency. It's nothing that had to go forward on a timely basis. They could have said, the law's incorrect. We can't spend the money. We got to wait until we get it straightened out. That's the proper process to follow. And who's on watch, who's captain of the ship, maybe Commissioner Lamb didn't know what was going on, but the people underneath him who carried out this work certainly did know what was going on. Those are the same people that were in the agency in 2001 that are in the agency today. And I might add in my discussions with Commissioner Lamb, and he can correct me, that these individuals were not reprimanded, and to my knowledge, in conversation with Commissioner Lamb in any way, shape, or form.
That was my next question. Okay. Follow-up, Representative Newman?
Yeah, real quick. Representative Krenke, do we in fact know that there were individuals within these two departments who did in fact know of the violation in this letter?
Representative Krenke.
The obvious, maybe not so obvious, the answer to that question is yes, because that's what the legislative auditor investigation was all about.
Mr. Chair. Representative Jacobson.
Mr. Chair, first of all, to that point, Representative Newman, I think Appendix B, the letter from the department, is essentially saying that. They're acknowledging that this is a problem, but they went ahead and did it anyway. If I may, Mr. Chair?
Representative Jacobson.
Commissioner, you more or less represent this as a misinterpretation. I'm looking at the letter from the department. I have a hard time calling this a misinterpretation. You're basically in this letter saying, well, you, not you, but whoever was responsible for this, is saying, we know this is a problem, yet you went ahead and did it anyway. To me, that's just flat-out wanton disregard. If I were to do that in my employment and go against my employer's wishes, I know what would happen, as I would expect most of us at the table know. I'd be gone tomorrow if I did this. I think this is something that you definitely need to address beyond just saying, oopsie, taken care of, and the matter resolved.
And it seems like, to that point, it seems like one of the recommendations from Mr. Nobles, or a letter to Mr. Nobles, is that, misread this one. It was from the department explaining why they shouldn't spend the funds. They have to pay the funds. Okay. Other questions? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish.
The money they're looking to get paid back, could they afford it, or are they just saying they're going to have to lay people off to scare us? Representative Frankie, you know, could you look at the budget? Could they pay it back without laying people off?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Cornish, I would certainly have to most likely agree with the commissioner. He knows the agency. He knows what would need to be done to address the situation. So they do have approximately 13 million dollar a year, $12 million a year annual appropriation. So within the $12 million, let's say, for the upcoming fiscal year, could they find out of that $13 million, could they find $163,000? I would think that'd be possible. I'm not going to usurp the authority of the commissioner, but it seems to me that maybe some agency-wide reductions with regard to could be cell phone use, auto use, other things. This is a fairly large agency, $163,000 or $162,000 over a $12 million budget. Might be difficult to find, but I just think that there's an important lesson for agency staff to learn from this experience.
Follow-up, Representative Cornish?
Sounds good.
Representative Rose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Freaky, just a question on your amendment. You used the word may use up to. What if they don't? It says may, it doesn't say they have to.
Representative Crinky.
Unless I misinterpreted.
Probably the question best directed to either council or to fiscal staff.
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, I wasn't totally aware of all the details of this situation. So, if the department has an obligation, a legal obligation, to make these reimbursements, then I assume that they'd have to use this money. And when I drafted this as a may, not knowing whether, in fact, they are legally bound to reimburse or pay or not. So if Commissioner Lamb knows that, Representative Krenke, that these are reimbursements that need to be made, I think you could probably use the word must.
Is there anyone here from the utilities industry to speak for or against this? Members, I'm kind of perplexed because I'd like to hear from the utility industry on this issue because I think it's vital to see what their input would be as far as this reimbursement goes. I think what I would like to do is lay this bill over and bring it up at a different time. We invite the public utilities people in here to get their input on this. I think that's key. Because it may not seem like a lot of money, but again, when we have employees who are not following the laws that we make and going ahead and using their own discretion to make decisions to, and especially when it comes to spending money, it's a serious situation. And I, you know, I do agree with Commissioner Lamb. It is a, you know, it's going to be a strain on his budget because he's going to have to cut some additional money, according to the governor, 3% out of his overall budget, which is going to put further strain on their operations. But yet, on the other hand, it was misspent. It should have been spent because they had no direction to do it. And so I'd like to hear, I think we owe it to ourselves, to hear from the utilities industry on this matter. So with that, I'll lay this bill over.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, appreciate it.
Yep. Next bill up will be Representative Erickson. Welcome to the committee, Representative Erickson. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be back on a committee that I served on for 2 years. In fact, I really miss not being here.
Is it really good to be back?
And, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate if you would move House File 2636 for possible inclusion in the State Government Finance Bill.
Representative Jacobson, do you want to move this?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Jacobson moves House File 2636, and this one will be looked at for possible inclusion in...
Mr. Chair and committee members, I have never requested general fund money in my 7-year career at the legislature, so this is a little different for me, but I bring it to you for 2 reasons. Number one, the opportunities allowed by this appropriation reach out to communities where disabled live and where they need help with assistive technology. Secondly, we can leverage federal dollars through this legislation, through this appropriation. And with that, I'd like to turn the testimony over to Carol Furry, who is the Executive Director of Minnesota Assistive Technology.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record and who you represent, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carol Furry, and I'm the Executive Director of Assistive Technology of Minnesota. Thank you for taking the time to hear our testimony today. I'll just spend a few minutes to give you some information about who we are, what our agency does. We are a statewide nonprofit organization that supports individuals with disabilities in the area of access and assistive technology, the devices and equipment that individuals with disabilities use every day to complete tasks of daily living. We are the only statewide nonprofit in Minnesota that provides such services. We work in partnership with groups throughout the whole state. We reach into every corner, and we have partners throughout the entire state who support our services and who are auxiliary services to help people with disabilities in the area of access, employment, and community living. In late August of 2003, in partnership with the Department of Administration, Assistive Technology of Minnesota applied for 2 federal grants. We were fortunate and received both of those federal grants. The 2 grants will provide about $2.2 million in federal funds for Minnesotans with disabilities, direct money to support individuals with disabilities. They are, number one, a loan program referred to as the Alternative Finance Program or the Microloan Program. In that program, we will be receiving $1.27 million of federal dollars. We are asking the state to provide $250,000 through this appropriation to help us with the required match. Assistive Technology of Minnesota will be required to raise $173,000 for a total of just about $1.7 million for the Alternative Finance Program. And remember that these are loan programs, so the individuals who use the programs will return the money to the fund. The second grant was through the Department of Rehabilitation Services entitled Access to Telework. It is, again, a loan program. It helps individuals who are underemployed or unemployed, individuals with disabilities, purchase the equipment they need for employment with emphasis on telework and flexibility in the workplace. We have no such program in Minnesota. We have the support of the Department of Rehab Services in Minnesota for this program. Under Access to Telework, the federal government has committed $862,000 with a required match in the state of $95,000. Of that $95,000, we're asking the legislature through this bill for $50,000. That would result in $1.5 million or $500,000 for Access to Telework. The microloan program and Access to Telework are two-of-a-kind programs in Minnesota. As I said earlier, no other program provides those supports. The loan program, the microloan program, is primarily used by families and individuals who have no either health coverage for equipment or have are purchasing something that insurance doesn't pay for, such as a van with a lift in it, hearing aids that are typically not covered, special computer adaptations that their child needs for school. For senior citizens, our loan program sometimes makes the difference between people staying at home and folks going into supported living because they can purchase the equipment they need to stay in their home. I just want to finish up by pointing out a couple of facts. 1 in 5 people in Minnesota have a disability. 3 of us, during our employability years, will become disabled. We are going to need the technology and the resources, the funding resources, to help us continue to use the tools that we're used to using in today's rapidly changing technology market. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Fury, this is a one-time appropriation you're looking at?
It is.
So this is really seed money to start to leverage federal funds and then to, it'll be all reimbursed through the loan payments that these individuals will make?
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Sounds like a very admirable program. Questions from the members? All right. Well, what we'll do is we're going to have to try to find some money. Is there anyone else here to testify for or against this bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
I know we can find money, and I think you do, too.
Uh-oh.
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
All right. Okay.
Is there? Do you wish to testify?
Yeah, one more person would like to. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you very much.
Please sign in if you have it.
Oh, yeah.
My name is Helen Fleck.
Oh, welcome to the committee. Are you representing yourself then?
I am.
Okay. You may proceed.
I feel like this has taken forever. Look at my gray hair. In 1978, I worked for Bill Nars. He had an idea that computers ought to be used for social purposes. So we put together a program that allowed long-term disabled employees who were bored stiff with being disabled and asked to do something. We put them back to work by a computer. From that, Governor Perpich, remember the days of the brain business? Anyway, we, at that point, Perpich put together a committee to decide what technology could do for the state. And among the things that evolved out of it was the problem of disabled persons. So now we're still doing it. We're still trying to make it possible for the people of Minnesota to use technology as it should be used, as it is available to them. That's what this is all about. I think I've said enough.
Okay. All right. Thank
Are
you
there any
much.
Questions?
Any questions for the testifier? All right. All right. Thank you very much, Mrs. Fleck. All right. Then, members, if there's no further questions, we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in our bill as we put it together. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Senator Burdall.
When you want.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Welcome to the committee, Representative Rudall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
And I'll move House File 2166.
This is General Register.
And be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register.
Did you move the amendment?
I just moved the bill. Do you want you have an amendment here?
Yes.
Okay, and that puts the bill in order. What are we doing here? I'll move the A2 amendment. Representative Rudall, what are we doing on the A2 amendment?
Okay, this bill 2166 is part of the Governor's Reorganization Order 190. It transfers oversight of education and training benefits for veterans from the Minnesota Department of Education to the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs.
Is that, excuse me, is that the amendment or?
The amendment.
I just need to explain the amendment so we can put it on.
Okay, it strikes the financial needs assessment.
Okay. And then effective date is the final, is the day of enactment? So,
yes.
Okay, all right. Any questions on the H2 amendment? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye, opposed, motion then prevails. Now to the bill.
Okay, sorry.
It's in order the way you want it.
Okay, the bill is part of the Governor's Reorganization Order 190. It transfers oversight of education training benefits for veterans from the Minnesota Department of Education to the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. The Department of Education requested this transfer because veterans have little to do with its K-12 education programs. Both the Departments of Education and Veterans Affairs support this legislation. I have with me the Deputy Commissioner Michael Puglisi.
Okay.
We'll answer any questions and explain as well.
Okay. Any questions from members? Okay. I think you're okay. And there's no fiscal impact I see at all on this, so we got a blank sheet on a fiscal note, which is nice. So then, if there's no further questions, I renew my motion for House File 2166 to be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the General Register.
Chairman, I don't see how the amendment does what the office said it did. Are we looking at the A2 amendment?
Okay, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chair, members, Mike Puglisi, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Veterans Affairs. Basically, Representative Kahn, what the amendment does, currently in statute, there's authorization that provides for the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs to provide emergency medical benefits. Unfortunately, due to recent budget reductions, we had to give up that funding. The language still exists and says that the Commissioner shall provide these benefits. What this amendment does is say, yes, we can still provide it as long as the available funding is there. So that should we get the money in the future, we can start providing this benefit again.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, that's not what the author said. The author said it's dropped the...
Mr. Shepard, can you shed some light on this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I believe Representative Verdahl was correct because under the current law, under this amendment, they would be able to provide, if they had the money, medical assistance to veterans without doing, making sure that they were financially eligible for other public assistance type programs. They wouldn't have to do a financial screening. They could provide assistance to veterans with emergency medical needs within the limits, as it says on the amendment, of available funding.
Representative Erdl.
Representative Kahn. Number three of the amendment reads...
the language.
I'll just read the number, line 16, number three on the amendment. Establish and provide assistance to former soldiers and their dependents who are in need of assistance with optical, dental, or other emergency medical needs within the limits of available funding. Adding that, you see, implies that if money is available, that those services will be provided, but we felt it was not appropriate to, you know, have the bill as it was before, imply to apply for them and discover there was no money. So we simply want to, we didn't want to completely take that provision out because we do think it's an important service to provide. However, being that there is no money there right now, it was unfair to continue to offer it with the previous language.
Representative Kahn.
Okay, I think I understand.
Is it okay?
Yes.
All right. All right, if there's no further discussion, then I'll renew my motion at House File 2166 as amended to be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, with that, we'll go to 2135.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Adult and Mr. Puglisi.
Thank you, sir.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Haas. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move that House File 2135 be recommended pass and then put on the general register. Members, what we have here is the Indian gaming bill for the White Earth Red Lake Band. We had this discussion in committee 2 weeks ago as far as the need for this to help two tribes in northern Minnesota. What we're here for today is the lottery will be the agency that will be leasing the slot machines to the casino and also accounting for the money that is collected and the oversight. So before you, you have a fiscal note that is quite detailed as far as the revenues and the expenditures within this proposal. And I have a representative from the lottery and also a financial consultant to the tribes to answer any questions that we have. And we may want to hear from the lottery, Mr. Chair, on their thoughts on how this is going to operate.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chairman, members, Don Feeney, Research and Planning Director, Minnesota State Lottery. Mr. Chairman, as far as the lottery's view of the bill, first I should state that on this and on other measures of this sort, we are not here as advocates or opponents of the bill. We've been asked to analyze the bill. We've been asked if we can operate the facility that's called for on the bill. And the answer is, yes, we can. We've also been asked to prepare a fiscal analysis of the bill, and that's the major portion of the fiscal note that that you have before you. Representative Haas, is there anything in particular you'd like me to address?
I think you might be best just to explain how the operation of the lottery, how it would work with you leasing the lottery, the slots to the casino.
Mr. Chairman, members, the bill calls for the state through the lottery to be the owner or lessor of the gaming machines that are at, that would be present at this facility. We would not be the owners or operators of the facility itself. We believe that the most efficient course of action would be to lease the machines rather than to purchase them. We envision approximately 4,000 machines at the facility. The machines would be connected to the central computers at the lottery office electronically so that we would know at the end of every day, in fact sooner if we wanted to, precisely how much money had been taken in on each machine, how much money the state should be receiving from the facility. We would have a complete electronic and paper trail of all of the transactions that took place on that machine, including prizes paid out. As such, we would be able to identify very, very quickly exactly how much money the state has taken in and how much money should be distributed to the beneficiaries called for in the proposal. We believe our staffing needs under this proposal would be minimal. My immediate guess is perhaps three additional staff in security, accounting, possibly marketing. And That would be the principal extent of our involvement, in addition to the negotiations with the owners of the facility that are called for in the bill. We would likely have one security person officed on site, perhaps more, depending upon what the needs of the operation tend to be.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Feeney. Before I throw it up to members, Mr. Feeney, just a concern of mine. Is there anybody on lottery staff that has any experience at all in administering or monitoring casino operation?
Mr. Chairman, directly operating casino operations, monitoring casino operations, no. However, in most respects, this is really little different than dealing with a 3,500 retail outlets, all of which report their revenues to us in much the same way through electronic control through our central computer system.
Questions from members? Representative Hilty? Or Representative Hoffs, do you have a point?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Feeney, if I'm understanding the fiscal note correctly, I don't think it would be possible for us to actually book revenue from this operation if it went forward until the year 2007. Can you tell me how much expense the lottery would have prior to being able to recoup any of that expense from the operation of the casino?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, could you explain to me, please, why you don't believe there would be no revenue until fiscal 07?
Representative Hilty?
I believe that would be the case because this is a major facility that would have to be constructed and be up and running before we did realize any revenue. If you disagree with that date, in any case, there would be, I presume, some degree of effort and expenditure of time and labor on the part of the lottery before any revenues were realized. So could you give us an estimate of what that would amount to?
Mr. Feeney.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, regardless of what the start date would be, I think our expenses prior to that start would be limited to staff time, primarily in preparing bids for the computer equipment that would be necessary. The machines would be leased and they would be paid for on a percentage of revenue basis, so there'd be no expense until the machines are installed and running. It would likely be the same situation with the computer system that is involved in that. Typically, when this has been done for operations in other states, it's been done on a percentage of revenue basis, so again, there would be no expense. The hiring of staff would not have to take place until the operation of the machines is really imminent.
Okay. Additional follow-up, Representative Hilton? Oh, Representative Haas.
Mr. Edwards has a comment to that also.
Thank you for being here. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Yes, my name is Valerie Redhorse, and I'm chairman and CEO of Redhorse Securities, acting as a financial advisor. Representative Hilty, the proceeds of the financing, which would be done prior, would include all the cost of construction of both the temporary facility and the permanent facility. The state would not incur any of those costs, and the sprung structure, whether it be leased or purchased, to house the temporary facility, which we anticipate would be 2,000 slot machines initially, which would bring in immediate revenue during construction. And this is done quite often on a lot of the projects I've worked on, especially in California, where you have a deadline to get started in order to have your licenses remain active. Typically, we put these sprung structures in a parking lot area so that the construction goes on simultaneously. And so you are able to realize and generate revenue almost immediately. And those proceeds, in order to get the sprung structure up, are put into the financing package, and then you start immediately realizing revenue from slot machines.
Any further questions, Representative Hiltunen?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, Ms. Reynolds, my question, which I will try to restate for Mr. Feeney, was, am I understanding you correctly to say, Mr. Feeney, that there would be, that the state lottery is going to oversee this operation and make sure that everything is done properly? The state lottery is going to handle the transactions whereby machines are leased, and yet that's not going to be any expense ahead of realizing revenues?
Mr. Feeney.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, that's my belief. I'm just, we believe that to be correct, and we're basing that on the experience of the states that have had to conduct primarily casino operations, West Virginia, Delaware, Rhode Island, several others.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Feeney, I think I'm missing something here. You're telling me that you're not going to have any staff involvement prior to this operation being up and running? Or are you telling me that this is something that you can handle with existing staff, or they'd sit around doing nothing currently? Or,
Mr. Chairman,
what are we talking about?
Mr. Feeney.
I think, Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, I think Mr. Feeney already said that there would be some staff time that would be used to put together bids for the computer equipment that they're going to need to operate this. But when you look at the financials and there's a 15% expense factor that's built into it, that will more than reimburse us for any staff time that we will put into the time that we've used to bid out computers. But as far as the equipment goes, Ms. Redhorse and both Mr. Feeney have testified that once there's no payments due on those until they start collecting revenue, and that's when the payments come due on the leases. So we're not going to have any, you know, capital upfront cost for the purchase or the installation of that equipment. So we're, you know, we're not going to incur cost. And if there is some staff time in that can be reimbursed through the proceeds that are coming in under the expense allowance from this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, I understand that. My question is, since a lot of work would have to be done on this project before it started generating revenues, the question was, in this biennium or even in the next biennium, before this project is capable of reimbursing lottery staff time, how much staff time would be involved in this and what would it cost?
Representative Hilty, we're probably looking at, and it's probably an overestimation of time, but at minimum or a maximum of 100 hours spent by staff, which isn't a whole lot of time to send out the bids, and depending on how many bidders come in, that will depend on how many hours it's going to take. If they have a lot of bidders, it'll probably be more, but it'll still be under the 100. If they have less bidders, it'll be less. But that's not a lot of staff time. And I know in our visit with the lottery the other day, in our discussions on the overall operation of the lottery, they said, you know, in certain things you have to spend money to make money. And that's basically what's true here. If we have to expend a couple hundred, you know, maybe a couple hundred, but if we have to expend up to 100 hours to get this thing up and operational, I think that's a wise investment to the benefit to the citizens of Minnesota, the Environmental Trust Fund, and, you know, to the Native American community that's going to benefit from this also. So I think when you weigh these small investment in hours to the cost-benefit analysis of what this is going to generate and who it's all going to help, it's a very minimal amount. And our returns are going to be far greater.
Additional comments, Representative Hilty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for Mr. Redhorse. Mr. Redhorse, how many operations comparable to this have you been involved in? What is your experience in financing casino startups?
Ms. Redhorse.
Yes, Representative Hilty, and is it Chair Jacobson?
Temporarily.
Prior to IGRA, which was the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, I first started out my experience as a young college student at a firm where we financed gaming operations in Las Vegas, and I learned there from 1978 to 1985 at a firm called Drexel Burnham Lambert, and I financed a number of casinos as a member of high-yield bond teams such as the Golden Nugget and MGM and Circus Circus, so I understood how to finance a casino from startup to finish. Since working with Indian casinos, I have worked on about seven, and right now I am currently working on one that would be identical to this model, and that is located in California, and I'm co-managing that deal with Morgan Stanley, and it'll be close to $300 million, and we are intending to go to market in April or May of this year, so I'm right in the thick of doing exactly the same structure.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Redhorse, I wasn't asking so much about your entire resume as
the market itself.
The firm that you...
Ms. Redhorse.
My firm itself, Redhorse Securities has done about three deals, and I've worked for a number of firms prior to that. I had a firm which I no longer own, and I've also co-managed deals where I've been a co-manager. We are a small firm, so I work with larger banks and would recommend, if we move forward, I'm working as a financial advisor on this deal right now to the tribes, and I would absolutely recommend a deal this size that we would bring in a larger bank and do an RFP process and work with another bank such as Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs or Bank of America, who have led the larger deals in the marketplace. It's my experience is in understanding sovereignty and Indian finance and tribal economic development and working hand-in-hand with the larger banks.
Representative Strand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick one. I think it's for Chair Haas. And correct me if I'm wrong. So we have 1.5% of the receipts going to the city and county in which this would be located, which I think, according to the fiscal note, is $1.2 million per year. And I guess part of it is just a comment. That would seem like a lot of money, but there's a lot of demands placed upon the city and county in which this would be located in terms of public, you know, the police department and the transportation department and roads and that kind of thing. So I assume, could work with that number if we needed to as we move along.
Representative Haas.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Strand, that was put in there for the cost there, and it's also, you know, if you look at the projections that we're looking at have been very conservative, because, you know, I think it's best to work at the lowest number possible rather than, you know, say we're going to offer the moon and go for the sun, you know. So that's what we're doing. So that figure will change, and then as the revenues come in, it'll change, but we can take a look at that.
One more additional question, Representative Strand.
Sure, thank you.
Maybe I'm just missing it here, but it is, would the receipts from this bill, which would serve to benefit the Red Lake and White Earth tribes, be statutorily driven in terms of whether or not they would ever end up being per capita payments, or is that a tribal decision?
Chair and Representative Strand, that is a tribal decision.
Yes.
We are just earmarking what the state would receive and where that money would go in general fund and that, and then the balance would go to the, and then the operation cost and then the balance will go to the tribes, and it's their decision.
Okay.
And they have rules and guidelines already set up on that money will go to economic development first, and they have to do that. And then from there, it's basically a decision of the tribe of how they're going to proceed after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is for this Red Horse. Anybody can answer. How is there financing in place for this deal yet? Maybe.
Ms. Red Horse.
Chair Jacobson and Representative Thiessen.
Yeah.
What I have done is produce a sensitivity model for the tribes that if this were to pass, how we would structure this. And my recommendation would be to do a new project finance tribal high-yield bond that we would do on the capital market. So it would be a bond. It would not be a bank loan. Bank loan money is not available for project finance for a gaming casino. I have a list of the outstanding bondholders who have bought and are currently buying Indian gaming bonds, and the market is good for it, and there is a market. I have given them an indicative interest rate and a non-call period so they know what to expect in debt service, and have done a complete sensitivity model for them. It is very financeable based on the location and the feasibility studies that we've done so far.
If I could just follow up.
Representative Thiessen, please continue.
So I trust that the tribes would issue the bonds?
The tribes would be the issuer of the debt, and the state would have no obligation in that, no credit risk whatsoever.
How long, in your experience, based on the other things and projects that you worked on like this, once approval is received, what's the time frame for getting those bonds issued and that whole process to run?
Right. Once we have approval to move forward and everything is in place from a documentation standpoint, we would create the offering memorandum. We would do the roadshow. There are certain steps that you need to take. It's about a 6 to 8 week eight week process to go to market. And I would say you need to allow more like 12 weeks because there's always some piece of information that needs to fall into place. And right now, like I said, the market is very, very good. And then what we would create, my recommendation, again, I would like to do it in co-managing with another bank, but we would recommend a 5 to 7 year note, but a non-call period of 4 years so they could refinance it in 4 years when they have the historical numbers coming in to get a better interest rate, because the high-yield market is a higher coupon right now than you would see in bank debt.
And if I can follow up,
Representative Thiessen.
The 12 weeks, that's, you said, after you get the documentation in place, what's involved in the documentation in place?
We would need to get engagement letters signed in terms of saying this is who is going to be leading the bond to the marketplace, so hiring the bank, hiring the legal team, bond counsel, issuers counsel, making sure we had everything in place politically from your end of it, saying this is a legal operational facility, and then you are required to do, under SEC and NASD registration, this would go to market as a 144A private placement. You have to do certain documentation in terms of notification to the securities and laying out all the information from a legal and regulatory standpoint, and it's simply declaring that, I'm going to say this right this time, Red Lake and White Earth are in fact sovereign nations, and sort of informational purposes. They have constitutions that allow them to do this type of thing, and it's more information to protect the investors and just typical to an issuance on the public markets.
And Mr. Chair, I've Representative seen some of those
additional follow-up.
But how long do you think that process to get the documentation in place would take? A couple months.
Ms. Reimers.
Go out and hire the bank and hire the lawyers and process that through Senate.
Before the 6 to 8 weeks starts, it's a factor of how fast everyone could work. I've seen it happen in 3 to 4 weeks, depending on how fast everyone's motivated to make this happen.
On average, though,
Two months.
And then, is there a location for this casino proposal? There's no specific location yet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, they're looking at a number of different locations, and they're in negotiations.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in terms of the location, any idea about how long that
process of, you know, actually finding the location, locating the location, and going through the transaction, actually acquire the location, which I'm assuming has to take place after you get the financing in place, because no one would do it without the financing.
No, you would actually have to identify the location first. The investors would want to know where the location is. That would be a factor in determining price and...
Right. Oh, that makes sense. Okay. But then you couldn't close on that until you get the financing. Is that right?
Right, you would need the financing for the piece of property, and that might be a separate debt issue because you could collateralize the property, so it might be a lower coupon and lower interest rate. My idea is to make this package as attractive as possible for the tribe, so if we can collateralize by putting a lien on the land, then we can get a lower rate. That might be bank debt. It might be a three-tranche sort of situation where you have your senior notes, which are uncollateralized, and then the land can be actually collateralized with a lien because it's not sovereign land.
And so that could actually run a separate from the land acquisition.
You could start on that as soon as you all, if you are so kind, pass this, and then we could start, you know, getting the land purchased, and that could happen prior to the bonds, while that documentation phase is going forward.
And Mr. Chair, if I
could... Representative, please continue.
But there's still going to be a period of time before that... that happens after this would be passed, because you haven't negotiated any particular deal at this point for where the location
would be. Mr. Chair.
Representative Foss.
They're looking at different sites, and so once this bill does pass, then they can narrow it down and get serious with those negotiations. That's why when you look at the fiscal note, you know, how soon can you get this thing up and running in a temporary facility? It all depends on the site they pick and then going purchasing the land. And then they have to go through the city planning process or the county planning process, wherever they decide to go. So it's, you know, and that can take anywhere from, you know, 8 weeks to 6 months, depending on all the information that the county or the city is going to require for that particular site, for their approvals or any exceptions or variations and, you know, internal, you know, all the engineering work that has to be done to draw the road access. And improvements that have to be made in sewer and water, depending on if that's an issue. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that have to go in. You know, once this bill is passed, they have to happen before they can actually even put up a temporary facility, because they're going to have a lot in place in utilities. And that's, you know, do they? If the thing is, if they have to go through a winter, they may not be able to get the utilities into the following spring. So, it's going to be a process, and it's just a matter of how, you know, the city or the county that they're working with, where this is going to be located.
Well, thank you, Chair, because that's kind of where I was going, because I was looking at the 2005. Mm-hmm. You know, we're getting $25 million out of this in 2005, and I'm just wondering if that's a really realistic number. And it sounds like it may be, but it's questionable as to whether it is. And that would be a pretty tight time frame to get that in.
And Mr. Chair, and Johnson, I have had discussion with the governor's office and our leadership to say that this is not money to be booked or tried to even be spent in 2005, because we don't know if it's going to be there. So it's best to worry about this in the out biennium.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, because it's just like me saying, I think I'm going to get a bonus at the end of the year, so I'll start spending money now. It doesn't work. So,
as I've learned.
Yes.
Further member questions? Representative Kahn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So have they agreed that is that an agreement? We're not going to see any of this money appearing in any budget that is projected in 2005 if this bill passes?
Representative Haas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I have not seen this appear in any of the budget work that we're doing now in revision with the governor's budget. Mr. Chair, may I clarify? The only money that they're looking at is Racino. That is the only money that they're planning on, because I have been very strong about not including this in there, because I don't, you know, you just can't bank on it, because there's too many factors, as Representative Teese and I were dialoguing about, that, you know, have to happen in order to get this thing up and running. I know the tribe would like to get it going as soon as possible, and I, you know, but again, when you work with government, and, you know, we've all kind of worked with, whether it's been a city or county or a school board, you all know the process that you have to go through. And so there's certain steps that have to be, you know, and everybody along those
lay on those steps have to have the information and be satisfied that it's going to work and they can do this and then proceed to the next step. So it's all timing and we just have to let the process work.
Representative Mr. Chairman, one thing that seems obvious to me is it's likely to take a longer time than a shorter time than anyone is projecting. And I don't quite understand how the contingencies are built in if it takes a significantly longer time. And then I have questions for Ms. Redforce on her background.
Representative Hahn?
Representative Kahn, could you clarify, and Mr. Chair, for me what contingencies you're talking about?
Well, just, if it takes, how long are you saying you're going to take to make the location decision?
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, that is not my decision. That would be the tribes, and it's a matter of, they have to negotiate.
Well, I mean, presenting the bill, you need to have some information about that.
Yeah.
I guess I wouldn't have minded seeing, as I wouldn't mind seeing now that we're starting to talk about this, I wouldn't mind seeing a flowchart about when the decisions are being made, when the money goes out, when the money goes in. I think I would feel more comfortable seeing that. And the other question is Ms. Redhorse, to go back, are you the only person who's involved in the financial backing of this? Are you the person who's doing the financial, totally involved in financial advice, or do you have a team working with you?
Ms. Redhorse.
Chairman Jacobson and Representative Kahn. Just to be very clear, I am not a financial backer. I am a licensed securities professional. I have 6 securities licenses, and I own an investment bank. And my investment bank has many employees, and we co-manage deals specializing in financing Indian casinos. So the tribes thought it would be prudent to hire me as a financial advisor to structure a deal for them in the event that the bill passes. They would need to know how they could finance this. And they would actually, I think it was smart of them to say, how would we finance this prior to coming in front of you, so they understand the process of how to get this to market and how to finance it. And so what I have done is structured a finance strategy for them based on the other Indian casinos in America, including the Mohegan Sun and the Pequot at Foxwoods and Chauncey, and the one that I'm currently working on, all have been new project finance construction. They all have been high-yield bonds. I have a list of the bondholders who have purchased these bonds. I know exactly how much they have cost and where they're trading at right now. And so I'm able to tell them what to expect and what they will have to go through and the timing issues and what would be required to be put in the indenture and the offering statement so that they understand the process and that I can hopefully explain it to you as well. But again, I'm not a backer in the sense I'm not putting up money. I am placing the bonds for them into the capital markets.
Okay.
Representative Kahn.
I was interested in the concept that you talked about, the kind of building on the parking facility. Could you go into the details about what that would be like?
Yes.
And where that's being used with the casinos that you've worked with?
Often construction of a permanent facility, casino, hotel, resort, takes anywhere between 12 months and 24 months. And in some states, in order to maintain your licenses for the slot machines, such as in California under the compact, you have to have your slot machines in operation before 12 months or within 12 months. So to avoid losing those licenses, many of our California tribes have started putting those facilities into temporary facility operations while they are under construction. It also makes sense here, even though you don't have the license limitation, if you have long construction periods because of weather, you can get your revenue stream coming in. And to Representative Hilty's point, you can see revenue before, you don't have to wait for the full construction period, and you can realize revenue almost immediately. So there are companies who make what are called sprung structures. They look like big white tents, and they go up almost immediately. I believe you can have them up in a week to 2 weeks, depending on the size. It looks like something you would hold a wedding in. But inside, you can house up to 2,000 or even 3,000 slot machines. And when you're inside, it's not nearly as attractive as a permanent facility, but from eye level, it looks almost the same as a permanent structure. If you look up, you're then looking at an attractive tent, but it's housing inside, it's warm, it's got all the utilities and all the amenities of what feels like a full, fully functioning casino, but it is in fact a temporary facility and is often placed where the parking lot will be so that the construction of the full-fledged permanent facility can go forward uninterrupted, and you are then able to realize your revenue stream prior to finishing that permanent facility. And that's how we would realize revenue sooner for the fiscal lottery in the years prior to the completed facility.
But why does it, Mr. Chairman, why does it seem to me that this is a structure that might be more amenable to California than to Minnesota?
Ms. Rambors.
They are weather, I'm not saying the names properly, I apologize, Chairman Jacobson and Representative Kahn. I have seen these sprung structures all over the country. I only pointed out California because it's over. They're actually weatherproof, and when you are inside these structures, one facility I was in recently actually had oak molding inside. You could hardly tell that it was a temporary facility. They are made very, very well and are weatherproof.
Representative Kahn, you look a little surprised at that.
Well,
any additional questions?
I guess one is that are any of the, I'm interested again in the previous history of how this has been done with other tribes that you've worked with.
Sure.
Are these then, are there public records of this whole, of these financial packages? Are these things traded publicly? Do they have the same kind of reports that you do on the stock market, you know, if one is for the bond sale, as one is, I'm not familiar with the bond market,
sure,
as I am with this. They have to do, you know, 10K and 4Q reports and so forth.
Chairman Jacobson and Representative Kahn, by virtue of the type of offerings that have happened for Native American tribal gaming operations, they have only been issued to date under 144A, which is private placement. Keep in mind, because they are tribal governments, you will never see a public offering of a tribally government-owned facility. The only time you might see that happen is if a tribe decided to form a corporation and then own an off-reservation casino. Sault Ste. Marie sort of has that going with its Greektown casino, but my point being, you can't have a publicly traded and owned tribal government. So what we have are 144A private placement offerings, and so there is some restriction on the public reporting of the revenue stream. Mohegan Sun has full disclosure of their casino operations, and I have here...
Just interrupt for a minute. Have you been involved in the financing of both Mohegan Sun and Foxwood?
I have been. I was on the Mohegan's latest deal, and I was not involved with the Pequots of their casino financing. I'm involved with some asset management work for Pequots. But I was on the cover of the latest Mohegan Sun offering with Bank of America. But they are publicly traded now in the secondary market. And I have a list here. What I provided for these tribes, they can see the price that those went out at, where they're trading at now, and the bondholders who purchased them. The thing you have to understand about both Mohegan and Pequots is they now have historicals in the marketplace of very, very good numbers, so their interest rates are much, much lower. They have refinanced a number of times. When Mohegan first was new construction, Bear Stearns did the offering. They had to do a land lease through the BIA to secure the property because they didn't believe it would work, and their interest rate was 14 or 15% with a participation piece of it that actually made it go up to 70% if you did the math in the long run. It's changed a lot since then. And so if you keep looking at the market and how it's improved, the latest Mohegan deal went out at 6 3/8, and it was still considered a high-yield deal. 6 3/8 is not really indicative of a high-yield coupon. So the market is very, very good for Indian gaming bonds, and it is a very strong market, And if we did this deal right now, it would be a very easy one to sell. We'd probably have oversubscription.
Well,
Representative Nala?
Yes. Mr. Chairman and Ms. Redhorse, I understand why O'Hagan's son or Pequot's would have a better interest rate when they go for an expansion. Is there an example now of what the interest rate would be for a startup like this startup? Has that been happening?
Yes. Chairman Jacobson and Representative Kahn, the latest new project construction that is comparable to this sort of financing was done by Bank of America last year, and the facility was called Chukchansi in Fresno, California. And I have done a full comparable disclosure of that deal for the tribes here. And that deal went out and priced at 14%, which is a high rate, but you have to understand there's nothing in the ground. It's called greenfield construction, and the investors are looking at construction risk and the fact that it's on sovereign land, and there's no sort of lien on the land or anything to collateralize. The next one going to market is the deal that I'm co-managing with Morgan Stanley, and like I said, we'll be going to market in May or June of this year on Shingle Springs Rancheria, also in California, for probably $225 million. We're still working on some of the numbers, but it will probably go to market at 11 or 12% because the market has improved since Chukchansi. And so what I'm thinking, this one, if we were to go to market, depending again on what I can't predict is how this will flow in terms of getting the approvals here, but if we were to go to the market at the end of this year, we could probably also get an 11 or 12% coupon. And then, like I explained, you structure it so there's a non-call period of as short as possible, meaning we're only stuck at that rate for 3 or 4 years, and then the tribe, once they have the numbers in the door, are able to refinance just like the Mohegans and the Pequots did at a lower interest rate. And then you're looking at bank rates, LIBOR plus 2, you know, where you can get into your 6, 7, 8% when you refinance, depending on where the market's at. Does that make sense?
Okay. Representative Hilty? Representative Kahn, are you?
For the moment, yes.
For the moment? Okay. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I presume that we're voting on this bill today. Just so the gavel doesn't fall out of your hand and hit the table, while I have the floor, I would like to ask for a roll call vote on this. And not to turn this into Groundhog Day, since we have heard this bill any number of times, and people have heard what I've had to say about it any number of times, I would just like to try to give a brief summary of my views on this, and I will try to be brief. First of all, I find myself totally in agreement with the position of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition against the expansion of gambling. And speaking of strange bedfellows, I find that I'm also in agreement on this issue with the Family Council and the Taxpayers League, who also are opposed to any expansion of gambling. And I am particularly opposed to any expansion of gambling that has the state involved in it. We have been hearing gambling bills in the Government Operations Committee and in the State Government Finance Committee for the 8 years that I have been in the legislature, year after year. And the argument that is made about expanding gambling is always, well, we're already doing it. Representative Haas, when we first were hearing this bill, you indicated that you are not in favor of any other expansion of gambling and that this was an exceptional case. But this afternoon, the Republican House Caucus laid out their supplemental budget plan, which relies substantially, more than substantially, almost entirely, on projected proceeds from the Racino at Canterbury Park. I mean, we have expansion of gambling coming at us from every direction. And a justification for it is that we need the revenue. I don't think there's ever any justification for the state being involved in raising revenue by means of gambling. We might as well just send crowds of state troopers out to mug people if that's the way we want to get money. We look at the fiscal note and in projecting revenues for this operation, whoever did the fiscal note thought that a comparable market was Detroit in terms of likely revenue per machine. I believe that Detroit is regarded as is the Twin City area by many analysts as a mature market currently. And yet we're talking about now implementing two major casino operations in this mature market, and it has been alleged that this wouldn't have any effect on current operations, that it wouldn't have any effect on the operations that have caused a great deal of positive economic development, particularly in rural Minnesota. There is the question also, I believe, of how this would actually help. I raised this question in the Government Operations Committee. This proposal has been around for more than a year, and we have not heard any specific plans for economic development or use of these proceeds. What we have heard is that the casino operations that Red Lake and White Earth have been involved in, because of their geographic remoteness, have not been successful. We heard the same thing about the other business operations that they have been involved in, that have started up and failed. There are a number of them. So it's difficult for me to see how simply pouring more money for economic development in an area that the very people that want to do that say is not suitable for economic development is going to help anything. And if you think about doing per capita payments instead, a rough calculation is that that would amount to something less than $4,000 per person per year. So it's difficult to see how that would help anybody very much either. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, I won't belabor this, but I intend to vote against this bill.
Before I recognize you, Representative Haas, just to set aside one of your concerns, Representative Hilty, there's one I can set aside. That is, I've got a towel in hand if necessary to keep. There won't be any slippery gavels today. Representative Haas.
Representative Hilty, you know, it's kind of interesting because you made arguments for and against what we're doing here. It's true, I've opposed gambling in the past. And what's different about this? This bill provides opportunity for a group of people who need some opportunity. You know, you talk about businesses failing. Yes, they've had some business failures up there, but look at the local economy. And look at the, you have a business up north, you know what it costs to get extra charges to ship materials back and forth and to get orders made and things like that. But you know, people start businesses every day and businesses fail every day. You know, we heard from the Secretary of State's office, they want to do yearly licensing of corporations. And then we heard about how many of the letters they're going to have to send out because to find out those people are still in business because they didn't pay their fees. And I think it was like 6,000 to 8,000 businesses a year. So
you know, the people who are living on the White Earth and Red Lake reservations are no different than anyone else in the state of Minnesota who want to take advantage of an opportunity. And you and I both have started businesses, and we've made them successful. What we're trying to do is give that same opportunity to the White Earth and Red Lake Band members, is to provide opportunities so they can create jobs on their reservations. They can have the opportunity to improve their health care facilities and hire in the people they need to run their facilities and make sure they're equipped properly, to build, rebuild their education system, get their schools built. You know, we saw in the video, the White Earth School is in tough shape, and so is Red Lake, and they need money to do those. That's what this is for. You know, they have a housing manufacturing process up on Red Lake. They build very quality prefabbed homes. And this business could thrive because it will create jobs so they can build homes for their own members. Plus, they can have the money to market and do the things that, you know, need to be done to get a product to market. But this is opportunity. That's what we're talking about. You know, and we're not only talking about Native Americans in northern Minnesota, but, you know, you look at what Mille Lacs has done for the city of Hinckley. Why can't the people of Red Lake and White Earth and all the towns surrounding the reservation up there have the same opportunity that you've experienced in Hinckley? That's what we're asking for in this bill today, is opportunity. You know, we're providing opportunity for people who live in the inner cities to get a job here. This is a jobs program for people who need a job. Yeah, you know, we heard the job figures came out. We're, I think, 2,000 or 3,000 net loss in jobs this last month in Minnesota. God, wouldn't it be nice to say we added 3,000 or 4,000 new jobs through this casino, and we're putting people to work, and we're giving people opportunity, and we're talking about people who are down and out right now on welfare. And I know members of your caucus, you know, did the deal the other day on food stamps on the news, and what it's like to live on food stamps and in poverty. We're looking at giving people opportunity to get out of poverty with this bill and get a job and get the job training they need. And they've even gone one step further to say these are going to be union jobs, they're going to be good paying jobs, because they want to make sure these people succeed so they get up and out of poverty. So when you look at what does this bill do, this bill is an opportunity for a lot of people, and it's an opportunity for Minnesota. Yes, the state would participate in some revenue, but you know what? They came to us and said, look, we want to be partners with the state of Minnesota. We didn't go up there and say, look, you want to build this? We want so much money. No, they came to us and said, look, we want to be partners, and here's what we'll bring to the partnership for you. This is, will be what you would get receiving in revenues. We want to help the state because we're citizens of Minnesota. That's what they are. They're no different than you and I. And when you look at Racino, do I agree with, you know, what our caucus is doing with Racino? You know, they did the same thing last year. And you and I both know when it comes down to negotiations, when the House and the Senate and the Governor's office get together, the both plans that the House and the Senate and the Governor have all proposed are all going to be massaged and worked over. And last year, Racino was taken out of the picture. But it's one way for our caucus to look at addressing some of the needs within the state of Minnesota. And the Native American community is saying, we want to help you address those needs. But we have not built into our budget anything from this bill, because I did not want that to happen, because we don't have this facility built, and I don't want to bank on something. You can't spend money you don't have. And so, members, this is positive. This is a real positive thing for rural Minnesota, especially in a depressed area in the state where they need jobs, not only on the reservation but off. But this is going to help all of Minnesotans. And the other key point, members, you got to keep in mind that 100% of the money that's earned in Minnesota is reinvested back into Minnesota. That is vital, because we are keeping the money here. We're not sending it other places. And I think that is very, very key in this bill. And so
what do we as legislators need to do? We're here to help people, and we hear it in all the committees, and, you know, how can we find money to help people? And we all have causes and needs within our communities that we're trying to help. That's what this is about. We're here to help people. This is our opportunity to not help a few people, but to help a lot of people. And that's what this bill is doing. So, members, I really appreciate your support, and stand for any further questions.
Representative Rhodes, then Cornish, and Conn.
Well, I think Representative Cornish is actually first, so.
Okay.
Right, I was.
Representative Cornish. Okay. So your stance corrected.
So you don't have to all wait in suspense for my roll call vote. I'm going to vote yes, and I never had any doubt that I was voting yes. It's a good bill. It's good accountability. I've been impressed with the testimony. I think we've got the oversight we need from the lottery. We've got the knowledge we need from the person sitting in these Red Horse. And it looks good to me. I am probably the only one here that's worked on or near both reservations for 20 years. I used to live at the Red Lake Reservation. I've gone on a number of times, and I've worked near the White Earth Reservation and gone on here a number of times. And I realize the needs of the people, and they haven't got anything else right now. And the reason that their casino isn't doing that hot is because of the geographic location and not because of mismanagement. And I think that I wish that the other tribes would go on board of supporting them and not opposing it, and realizing that their friends across the state need help too. And they've gotten the short end of the stick at White Earth and Red Lake for a number of years on funding and economic development. So I think this is a good idea. I think it's a bogus claim that this is an expansion of gambling. We've had gambling. The other night we raised $40,000 for Ducks Unlimited because of gambling. We got pull tabs all night long, the turkey banquets, the Ducks Unlimited banquets, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, the Grouse Society. We've been gambling for years. We've got pull tabs, American Legions. We've been giving Boy Scouts money from gambling proceeds. I mean, it's ridiculous to say this is expansion of gambling. It's just a cheap way to shut it down. So I don't consider this an expansion at all, and it's needed. It's justified. I don't see the religious point there at all. I don't think anything in my background of scripture prohibits gambling. If you can afford it and you're not shorting your family, and that's a personal choice, if you choose to do it, if you're keeping up your other debts at home, you can gamble. And so I don't see anything that should prohibit this opportunity for these two well-deserved reservations, and wholeheartedly support the idea. And if you could move it down to Good Thunder, where I live, that would be great. Less named after Chief Good Thunder, I think that's where it should go.
Representative Rhodes.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Haas, you kind of rattled off some things I was going to touch on, but a couple of things. The facility is going to be in the metropolitan area, I think. Is that fair to say?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rhodes, somewhere up in the northern part of the metro area.
Well, instead of in my district, in your district, is that what you're thinking?
I don't think you have any room left, and we're just about built out.
Okay, but on a serious side, I think it's what we're doing is we're creating some. First of all, I believe, if I recall, some of the letters of support, a lot of the unions are supporting this. I believe that is correct, sir.
Representative
Chair, Representative Rhodes, that is correct.
Which means that they're going to be building. There's going to be a lot of construction and employment in the city. If I'm understanding correctly, we're going to also, one of the benefactors of this is that a lot of the members of this tribe that happen to live in the metropolitan area that are currently now on assistance of some type. I don't know what numbers, and maybe you may have that number or not, but I suspect they will. We're going to have an extra. This is kind of like putting on a cigarette tax. It's a win-win. You stop people from smoking, it helps health care if you put the money in the right direction for that. This would be the same thing as getting. We're going to not have to pay out for assistance, because they're going to be able to be they're going to be able to take care of themselves. At the same time, we're creating jobs. At the same time, we're helping also the tribal members that don't live in the metropolitan area. And the whole thing is based on the fact that they will have a piece of the action, if you will. I respect, if you don't gamble, that's fine. I respect you for not supporting that. I, as we all know, we've heard this discussion before. I help people get out of debt that are gamblers. But the realistic thing is, as Representative Cross said, we have gambling, we have poll tabs, we have charities, VFWs, legions, all the pull tab operations all are gambling, and yet we accept that as okay because they're putting money back in. I think we're putting back money into society. We're helping people get out of a situation that is going to help everybody, including the next generation. And I think that's the one thing we haven't talked about is the fact that there's another generation coming up that may not have to live in this type of era, and I think that is really what it's all about, is we've been able to make this work. So that's my comments for the day.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Willits, it's not only for the Native American community in the inner city, it's for the minority community in the metropolitan area. We'll have the opportunity. So it's we're not just limited employment to Native Americans. If they want to expand it and help all the minorities in the metro area into a job training program.
Chairman, that's even better yet.
Yeah.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, and since this is a finance committee, I'm actually kind of concerned about the finances of this issue, and I'm concerned about several things that I think have been problems with the other operations. And so this is the first one that the state will have a part in, and so I want, if this is going to go forward, I don't want it to get into any of those problems. And so one of the issues that I've had is I don't see, and I'm thinking of some language that might go on page 13 after line 3. I want to make sure that every bit of the cost of this, that there aren't any hidden costs that are just passed on to the state, like to the alcohol, to the Attorney General's office, to the alcohol enforcement division, and so forth. Because there are a lot of things in the Indian casinos that are done by the tribes themselves. I'm unhappy with the fact that there may be a lot of unpaid for work being done for by the state, and that's something I wish that we would look at seriously and make sure that we're being reimbursed the amount that we should for any of the work that's done by the Attorney General, by the whatever that group in public safety that does gambling enforcement and so forth. And so I don't see where in this bill we see the fact that there won't be any cost, any extra cost to either the lottery, which is a state organization, or the state itself and its facilities. And what I was looking at was, and there may be more places that we need it, was that on page 13, after line 13, where it says the director may adopt game procedures and other actions necessary to regulate the conduct of the card games. I mean, that's the place where I want it to be, make sure that they're paid for any of those actions. I don't quite know how to write that language, within the limits of reimbursement from the facility or something like that. And if it says that somewhere else in the bill, then I'm happy. But, I don't want that just for the card games. I want everything that's done on this to make sure that there's total reimbursement of the state. And I wanted to say it in the initial bill rather than think about it later. And then I have a question on how extensive some of these prohibitions are.
Okay. So, Mr. Shepard, could we, Mr. Chair, Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair and members, I would perhaps in a way to deal with this globally would be on page 9, line 15. This is where the lottery director is entering into a contract with a person. The person is defined as the tribal entities, and this talks about the terms of the contract. And I would suggest, if you wanted to do that language, to the effect of that the director may not enter into a contract with a person under this section unless the person contractually agrees to reimburse the state for all documented costs incurred by the state in regulating the gaming facility or enforcing laws relating to the facility.
I think that's okay. Do you think that covers all of the things that I've suggested? It sounds like it does. It's better than nothing anyway.
Comments,
Mr. Chair and Mr. Shepard, where would we insert that then again?
Mr. Chairman, members, I was thinking on page 9, line 15, after the period, where it would be a condition of the contract, the initial contract that would be entered into by the lottery director and the corporate entity formed by the tribal governments. And I will write that up and give it to Ms. Carter.
Okay, I was just going to ask that, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I think that is a good condition.
Well, I would like to move that, but whatever.
No, that's fine. Representative Kahn.
Representative Kahn moves the insertion of the previously mentioned language, page 9, line 15. Any discussion to this amendment?
15, page line 9?
Page 9, line 15. Did I say it backwards?
9, line
15. Discussion on the amendment? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I have another question as to what, because this is, I think we've taken some of this from the lottery language, but this is the lottery doing something very different than it's done before. But that's on page 12. It says, the director or any employee of the lottery or any member of their immediate family residing in the same household may not play a game on a gaming machine or receive a prize from the operation of a gaming machine. Is that clear that it's gaming machines anywhere in the state?
Mr. Shepard, would you care to field that one?
What?
Mr. Chair and members, just as I read this off the top of my head, the term gaming machine is defined in Chapter 349A, and the term is used. On which page, Representative Kahn, will you refer
to? I'm on 12, and I'm looking at lines 13 to 16. And I want to know if that just means gaming machines at this facility or gaming machines anywhere in the state.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd have to read it a little bit more carefully, but I would think that it only relates to the gaming machines at this facility. But I can't state that for certain without looking a little more closely at the way the bill is written.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, the point I would like to make is that one of the reasons why we don't is that some of these employees are going to gain an insight into gaming machines that no other customers of casinos throughout the state would have. And I don't know if, for example, I don't know what the rules are in places that have lots of different facilities like Nevada. We obviously have no rules because they're all run by just the associated tribes. But I know in places in are they allowed to take, for example, the knowledge that they have from knowing how machines work and gaming facilities work and then go use them at another facility? And what are the laws of the state? Can gambling employees gamble anywhere they want except at their own facility? I don't know that, and I don't know if it's something that this is the first time that we'll have the state, and remember, I don't care very much about what goes on. I don't go into casinos except to eat occasionally when I'm in the area, but the state isn't involved in those really, so I don't really care what goes on in those. But here the state is getting involved, and so what should the state do for its employees?
Mr. Feeney, can you shed some light on this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I am not aware of any private casino operations that prohibit their own employees from playing the games. From my knowledge of the way the machines operate, which is not, I am not an expert, my understanding is that it would not be possible for an employee of ours, under the way that this bill operates, to gain any sort of information that would be of any use whatsoever in enhancing their own personal income.
Additional Representative Kahn?
Well, then why do we have the prohibition in subdivision B at all?
Mr. Feeney?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I did not write the bill. I can't answer that directly. Pertaining to the rest of the lottery legislation, something that I do know is that there is no way that an employee of the lottery could reasonably influence the outcome of the games under the security procedures we have. However, we believe that the perception of an employee winning particularly a major prize under the existing lottery would be such that it would not be desirable to have employees playing playing the lottery. If that was the intent under this section, I don't know.
But is
Representative Kahn.
So, did you find the definitions, Mark, that say how that works?
Mr. Schenfer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I would, if the intent of the committee were to prohibit lottery employees from playing or receiving a prize from a gaming machine anywhere in the state, I would think you should consider saying that specifically, because I don't think it says that specifically right now.
Representative Kahn.
I mean, is the term gaming machine listed just to the... I mean, it says they may not play a game on a gaming machine.
Representative,
or receive a prize from the operation of the gaming machine.
Representative Kahn, I just passed a note by an individual who said that even some of the casinos prohibit their employees from playing in their own casino.
They all do.
Pardon?
They all do.
Do they all do? Okay.
Mr. Feeney?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, this is an area that is of some concern to mine, that some of the people who are most at risk of developing a gambling problem are casino employees. Those that prohibit it, I believe, do for that reason, but there are enough casino employees who get into trouble at all sorts of facilities that I know of many instances where they've gotten into trouble from playing at their own facilities.
Additional comments? Representative Paymar, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment. Unlike Representative Cornish, this wasn't an easy decision for me to make. I really have struggled with this. In fact, I didn't really make up my mind, I think, till last night. It seems to me that it's unfortunate that when the compacts were constructed that Governor Perpich and when the tribe sat down, that there wasn't some way to really think through some intertribal revenue sharing with the existing casinos. It seems to make sense that the closer you are to the Twin Cities, you're going to have a more lucrative casino. And it seems to me that the people who sat down at those tables 12, 15 years ago should have been smarter than that. But suffice it to say, we have the compacts now. I don't know if they'll be reopened. I can see why this bill is enticing to people, Representative Haas. I'm very sympathetic to White Earth and Red Lake, and I think this bill would help both of those tribes. But for me, it really did, and Representative Hilty talked about it a little bit, but it really ended up last night when I was thinking about this, that it really came down to me that you can't get away from the fact that this is an expansion of gambling. And it also, you can't get away from the fact that we're looking toward gambling as a way to fund government, not just today with the Rossino bill, but also into the future. And that concerns me. I'm not a moralist on the gambling issue, but I have to say, in my other job, I spent a lot of time in Nevada this last year. And if we want to go down the road of Nevada, we're maybe taking the first step today. You see, in city after city, you can't even stay in a hotel. And I'm talking about the outskirts of Nevada. I'm not talking Las Vegas and Reno. You can't stay in a hotel without having a casino there. And you can see the impact. I was there trying to deal with family violence problems that they're having in Nevada and the social problems that have occurred because of gambling. Addictions, increased crime, broken families, domestic violence, chemical dependency. And it's all related. You can't get away from it. So if it was just, we had some assurance that this was the only casino that was going to be built, and this was it, you know, maybe I have a different view of it, but I guess I don't trust government right now. I don't trust the fact that your leadership and the governor. Yes, I just don't trust that we're not going to be balancing our budget on future gambling proceeds. And that's what we're doing with Racino. It's exploitive in my view. It's regressive in my view because the poor people who really can't afford to gamble are gambling, and then hence it becomes tax revenue for the state of Minnesota. So the bottom line for me is that should the state be in the casino business? I mean, that is a dramatic change. Should the state be in the casino business? And then I guess the final point is, when will it end? Representative Boudreau had a bill that was well-meaning to use the proceeds of her casino plan to fund higher education. I think there was a casino plan to fund the sports stadiums. I mean, are we going to have a casino to fund health care, casino to fund ECFE? I mean, when will it end, and what are we turning into is what I'm concerned about. So while I'm sympathetic with the bill and actually thought about supporting it, I don't know what's happened in the last few days. I've been lobbied to death on this bill, and I apologize to those who I've been short with over the last few days, but this has not been an easy decision. Including you, Representative Bill. I think that's going to be part of my office. But I think this is a tough issue for us to struggle with, and I'm going to vote against it.
Further questions from members? Anybody else? Before we move on, Mr. Feeney, assuming this passes, I would like to sit down with you separately and go through the fiscal note. I have some grave concerns regarding the internal control. I'd like to do it. I could take all night, and I don't want to do that. I don't want to waste members' time.
Then we'll lay the bill on the table.
I'm willing to do that separately to look specifically at the internal control implementation. I'd like to know a little bit more about that. Last shot. Anybody else with any questions, concerns?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Haas.
Representative Kahn, I think maybe what might be best for you and I on page 12 and your concerns on 13 to 16 is maybe try to address that between now and the time that this bill would eventually be brought up on the House floor, to see if we can work on some language that might be comfort language to address your concerns, because I think you have a valid point there that we need to look at some of this.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hilty.
I failed to note in the initial motion, but doesn't this bill have to do with Ways and Means?
Representative Haas, would you care to touch that one?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I have talked to Representative Knobloch about this bill in regards to going to Ways and Means, and at this time it would not, because it would not have any fiscal impact in this biennium that we're looking at.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fawcett, that was sort of the first question I asked of Mr. Feeney, and I don't think that we really have a satisfactory answer to that at this point. It's still unimaginable to me that the current lottery staff, we have no significant time in this project until it was up and running.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Haas, would you, or Representative Kahn?
Well, I think I assumed it was going to Ways and Means. I think the motion should be amended to send it to Ways and Means.
Representative Haas, your
thank
conclusion
you,
on that?
Mr. Chair. And as I said, Representative Kahn, I've talked to Representative Knobloch, and he thought it would be okay to go to the floor with this. And if future date, if they would have to, due to more information or something, if they have to bring it back to Ways and Means, we'll make a motion on the floor to move it back there.
Representative Kahn.
I mean, lottery people started to work right away, as far as I can see. I don't understand how there can be no fiscal impact. and they don't, and no money comes in for quite a while. I don't even think it's a close call. I don't know how closely Representative Knobloch looked at it, but I don't even think it's a close call that it should go to Ways and Means.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, this is just a total financial bill. We have all kinds of numbers in it about percentages going for various entities. If it doesn't go to Ways and Means now, when would it ever go to Ways and Means?
Chair and Representative Kahn, if we would need to go to Ways and Means, maybe we could, you know, if we move it to the floor, we can get some more information from the lottery to see if there are real expenses, and if there are, then we'll move it back to Ways and Means to have those addressed there. If there aren't any significant expenses or, your questions, if then we can just leave it at the floor and let it be brought up at that point.
Well, you can do the reverse. We have bills that come here and we say there's no fiscal impact. They can go, you know, we had them because we thought there was a fiscal impact. No fiscal impact, and they can go, and then it can go to the floor. But, you know, I think the points that Representative Hilty made are clear. I don't see how you can get this started without a certain amount of significant state expenditure and lottery expenditure. We put all kinds of constraints now. We have other bills going on and all kinds of constraints about what the lottery is going to do. Does this mean that the lottery, with those constraints, and that's why I really, with those constraints on what the lottery has to do, with those constraints on what the lottery can spend on administration, and then you give it this job, does that mean that the constraints that the lottery is spending on administration, that the what it spends on this comes out of that pool, and then is that all right with the lottery? Then, you know, in terms of what the lottery proceeds are going to be, I guess I'm particularly concerned about language that we took off a lottery bill yesterday, saying that you didn't have to maximize the profits to the lottery. So then, for example, the lottery can just work totally on this, looking on it on the future, and just let the lottery go. You know, I really think those questions, I think you ought to let, you need to answer those questions here to make sure that the answer is zero for this biennium, or you should send it to Ways and Means to be answered there.
Follow-up, Representative Haas.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Jacobson. Representative Kahn, I think the amendment that you put on earlier, the oral amendment, would address if there are any costs to the lottery, it would be reimbursed, so there would be no net loss to the lottery and to the Environmental Trust Fund or anything from the proceeds.
Well,
so there wouldn't be, you know, any negative effect. And meeting with Mr. Vekic, he could not be here today because of a business trip that he had through his own personal business that he owns. Could not be here. He's out of town. But he did not see that this would be a problem with going through and getting this operational with the lottery. And maybe Mr. Feeney may want to address it.
You know, again, I respect Mr. Vekic, but by his own language, by his own admission, he's been at the lottery 30 days. And I don't think he fully understands what the constraints of, and that's just the lottery. That's not thus this whole new casino operation that we're putting in there. I mean, I don't understand. I guess I'm going to then move to amend the motion that it go to Ways and Means.
Any further discussion on that amendment? Or the amendment to the motion, I guess it would be.
So, Mr. Chair, are we voting on the bill, or are we voting
on the
motion?
We are voting on the
motion
to amend the motion.
Which I didn't think was necessary, but if it is, I guess we will.
Mr. Chair, you know,
Representative Haas.
Why don't I just renew my motion that House File 2135 be recommended, passed, and be referred to the Committee of Ways and Means.
I think we have a resolution there.
Okay.
I think everyone's in favor of that. All right. Representative Hilty, just to make you comfortable as we're reaching that point, I'll make sure my hand is dry. That will not slip. Representative Haas, having renewed his motion that the bill be referred as amendment to the Committee on Ways and Means, the clerk will take the roll.
Haas?
Yes.
Jacobson?
No.
Hilty?
No.
Cornish?
Yes.
Kahn?
Yes.
Newman?
Yes.
Hamar?
No.
Rhodes?
Yes.
Braun?
Yes.
Thiessen?
No.
Like a 6-4.
It is.
The vote being 6 in favor and 4 against, the motion does prevail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
And being no further business in front of the committee, meeting adjourned. Okay.